It was sometime after midnight when the fuel light on my car started flashing.
No!
I screamed, eyeing the gauge that was creeping closer and closer to zero. I thought I had enough to last me to the next town, but it didn't look like that was going to be the case. I was on a stretch of road that seemed to be in the middle of nowhere, just a long serpentine path stretching miles and miles through empty fields and abandoned buildings. Getting stuck out here was one of the worst things that could happen tonight.
Come on, just a little further,
I muttered under my breath, flicking my gaze between the road and the fuel gauge, willing it to hold on at least until I was somewhere with other cars and people around. Well, either by pure luck, or some kind of miracle, a sign by the side of the road flashed beneath the glare of my headlights. Gas station, half mile. I couldn't see any lights blinking in the distance, but maybe it was hidden behind a dip in the road, or was offset behind some trees somewhere, not visible from the highway until you were right on top of it. Feeling hopeful I wasn't going to be stranded out here, I pushed on, keeping an eye out for the gas station in case I drove straight past it. It appeared almost suddenly on the other side of a hill, a small, run-down-looking building with two gas pumps out front. I felt nervous about the lack of other cars, and only one of the lights was working, flickering every so often to cast the station in brief bursts of darkness. With no choice, I pulled the car up outside one of the pumps and cut the engine, climbing out. The smell of petrol was particularly strong, and I wrinkled my nose as I began filling up, keeping one eye on the meter and the other on my surroundings. It was too dark, too quiet out here that I almost felt like I was somewhere I shouldn't be. I finished filling up and headed inside to pay. The store was just as dingy and run down as the outside, and the attendant behind the counter was a bored-looking young man who could barely stop yawning. I paid for my gas without any trouble and headed back outside, eager to get back into the car and keep driving. I noticed then that I was no longer alone. A woman was hovering by my car. She looked so out of place amongst the grimy gas pumps that I almost thought I was imagining things. She turned to face me, and I was struck by her unimaginable beauty, her blue eyes capturing mine like two sapphires.
Excuse me, is this your car?
I cleared my throat. Yes, that's my car, I said.
It's a very nice car, she said, a hint of flirtation in her voice. Does it have a nice owner, I wonder? You see, I'm looking for a lift, she continued, stepping towards me, her heeled boots hitting the ground sharply. You look like the kind of man who wouldn't deny a woman in need.
Where do you need to go?
Out of town. Are you heading that way?
I followed her painted red lips as she spoke. Yes, I am.
Perfect, she said, flashing me a flirty smile.
I nodded, gesturing to the passenger seat. Sure, hop on in.
Thank you so much.
She climbed into the car, and I went round to the driver's side, trying to cool my composure. I wasn't used to having such beautiful women in my car, and for the first time, I felt vaguely embarrassed by the clutter on the floor and in the back seat. The woman, however, didn't seem to mind. What are you doing out here so late, anyway? I asked as I pulled away from the gas station onto the empty road.
You know, she said vaguely, waving her fingers around. Just trying to get away from someone.
I cast a curious glance towards her, but she was looking elsewhere, out of the window. My gaze lingered for a moment before I yanked it back to the road, feeling heat creep up my neck.
Are you from around here? She asked suddenly.
No, traveling for work, I explained. She nodded, making a noise that was between a sigh and laugh.
You won't have heard the local urban legend, then?
Urban legend? No, I don't think so, I said, frowning at the direction the conversation had gone.
They say there's a mysterious woman around these parts, who lures men from gas stations in the dead of night and takes them to their death.
It took a moment for her words to sink in.
I forced out a laugh, assuming that she was just messing with me, but I still felt a sliver of dread creep across my spine. The woman had gone silent again, and when I looked towards her, she was smiling at me, her red lips shining beneath the moon. Something else caught my attention, and my gaze traveled down to her dress. There were patches of it that were darker than the rest, like something had stained it, something that looked remarkably like blood. My heart pounded in my chest, and I switched my attention back to the road. Beside me, the woman started humming, a strange melody that filled me with nothing but crushing fear. Was she really going to kill me? Or was she just trying to scare me?
"Here's fine."
Her voice startled me, and I twitched to face her, taken aback. What?
"You can drop me off here."
Now, on any other occasion, I would have been hesitant to leave a woman alone in the middle of nowhere, but this time, I wasn't going to refuse. I slowed the car to a stop and put on the brake, swallowing thickly. She turned to face me, her sapphire eyes now cold as ice. Her smile widened further as she reached into her jacket and pulled something out, something that glinted silver and sharp beneath the light of the moon. I never should have stopped the car. My heart thundered as the glint of silver caught my eye. It was a knife, wickedly sharp. And in that moment, everything inside me screamed to run. But I couldn't. I was frozen, my hands gripping the steering wheel so tightly my knuckles turned white. The woman's smile twisted into something monstrous, her sapphire eyes now shimmering with malice.
"You shouldn't have stopped,"
she said softly, almost regretfully, tilting her head. Before I could respond, she lunged. Instinct took over, and I threw my arm up, catching her wrist before the blade could pierce my chest. The car erupted into chaos, her laughter echoing like shards of glass in my ears. Desperate, I slammed my foot on the accelerator, the car lurching forward as we struggled. The knife clattered to the floor, but she didn't stop. Her nails raked across my skin as she climbed over the console, her strength impossibly inhuman. "Get out!" I screamed, my voice cracking with terror. I swerved violently, the car skidding on the desolate road. She didn't flinch.
"You can't escape,"
she hissed, her breath icy and unnatural. Gathering the last shred of courage, I jerked the wheel, sending the car careening off the road. The vehicle plowed into a ditch, the force throwing us both against the seats. Dazed and bleeding, I fumbled for the door, tumbling out into the cold night. I looked back, expecting her to follow, but the car was empty. She was gone. The air was thick with silence, but her laugh still lingered, faint and haunting. I stumbled away, vowing never to stop for anyone again. Somewhere behind me, the hum of her strange melody floated through the fields. My mother-in-law, Paula, hated me. She thought I wasn't good enough for her son, and she made her feelings crystal clear every time I saw her. It didn't matter that I made more money than Robert, or that I had my own company while he went from job to job. All Paula cared about was that I wasn't pretty enough for her handsome son. We had Thanksgiving with my parents, so I thankfully didn't have to see her over the holidays. But then, that afternoon, after we'd all finished our meal, Paula called me out of nowhere. She asked if I'd like to join her for Black Friday. I didn't know how to answer. I assumed that this was some sort of olive branch, that she was trying to be a good person for once. I knew that if I said no, she'd get angry. I'd probably never have another chance to get on her good side. So I said yes. Apparently, Paula took her shopping very seriously. She told me to meet her at the outlet mall at 7 a.m. so that we could get in line early. She even had a list of which stores we could go to and in what order. "Sure," I said, even though 7 o'clock was way too early for me. I immediately told Robert about the conversation, and he was genuinely surprised. Like me, he took this as a very good sign that his mother was finally willing to give me a chance.
I woke up early the next morning and quickly got ready. Paula was waiting in the parking lot when I arrived. It looked like she'd just parked. The first thing she said to me was, "You're late." It was literally 7:02. I was 2 minutes late. She pointed toward the massive line of people that had already gathered in front of the doors. There was absolutely no way that all those people had lined up in the last 2 minutes, but Paula acted as if I was the sole reason we weren't first in line. I apologized, even though I didn't mean it, and we headed toward the line.
"It's too late," she said. "We'll have to find a shortcut."
Before I could respond, she grabbed my wrist and pulled me around the side of the building. We were in a side alley filled with dumpsters. Clearly, this wasn't an entrance. She walked toward a metallic ladder that led up to the roof of the building.
"Climb!"
she demanded.
"I'm not going to climb to the roof," I said.
And that's when she started to scream.
"It's your fault that we're late! Trust me, there's another entrance up there, and it's never locked! I've used it before!"
I still wasn't moving. So she grabbed the ladder herself and started climbing up.
"I knew I shouldn't have invited you,"
she said over her shoulder. I should have just left, but I was so desperate to get her to like me. I stupidly followed her up the ladder. When I reached the roof of the two-story building, Paula was waiting for me with her arms crossed.
"About time," she said. "Follow me."
She headed for the metallic door, looking weirdly proud of herself. But when she tried to open it, the door wouldn't budge.
"Damn it!"
Of course it was locked. What did she expect? Even though she'd said she'd gone in this way before, I knew that was a lie. I told her that we should go back down and get in line like everybody else.
"You think I'm stupid?"
she shouted at me.
"You were late on purpose! You wanted to ruin my Black Friday!"
She got closer and shoved me. Dangerous thing to do on a roof.
"Calm down,"
I told her. "Let's just..." She shoved me again, much harder this time. I lost my balance and stumbled over the ledge. In an instant, I was falling off the roof. I knew I was going to die. And the last image I would ever see was Paula's face looking down at me and smiling. Pain shot through my body when I landed in one of the open dumpsters, but it wasn't as bad as I'd expected. None of my bones were broken. I wasn't really hurt at all. I felt the material under me. It was soft and squishy. The dumpster was filled with old fabric and packing peanuts. That was the only reason I'd survived the fall. If I'd fallen even 1 foot to the side, I would have been dead. I couldn't see Paula, but I could hear her laughing as she climbed down the ladder. When she got to the bottom, she stopped in front of the dumpster and looked inside. I stayed perfectly still, pretending to be dead. I kept my eyes closed and held my breath. Her laughing stopped. I heard her make a call on her phone.
"Hello? I'd like to report an accident."
She was talking to the 911 dispatch, explaining that she'd just seen a woman stupidly try to sneak onto the roof. She said that she tried to tell me to climb back down, but that I'd slipped and fallen to my death. She was pretending to cry, too. It sounded so fake. I didn't know if she was still looking at me, so I kept motionless until she finished the call. Once she did, she leaned against the dumpster, causing the metal to creak.
"Good riddance to old rubbish," she said.
That's when I opened my eyes. I climbed out of the dumpster, not a scratch on me, and kindly offered to wait with her until the police arrived. I'm sure they'll be interested in what I have to say. Paula immediately ran away. By the time the police had arrived, she had already driven off. I told them exactly what happened, admitting that I had stupidly followed her up onto the roof, even though I knew it was wrong. The policewoman wrote everything down. "I understand," she said. "I have a mother-in-law, too." Thankfully, the roof had security cameras installed, so Paula's murder attempt was caught on film. They arrested her within the hour. When I returned home to my husband, I told him that I never wanted to see his mother again. He understood. I knew my roommate was strange from the moment I met her. And it wasn't just because of the disparity in our subjects. I was a history undergrad, she was studying to get a master's in biology. Her side of the dorm was a mess. The wall plastered in posters of strange fungi and dissected illustrations of animals. Her desk a minefield of scribbled notes and spilled coffee and petri dishes scattered amongst it all. My walls were clean and uncovered. My desk stacked neatly with history textbooks and papers, and the occasional half-empty mug of tea. I wasn't one to judge by appearance alone, and I still gave her the benefit of the doubt after seeing her room. Her first question to me was, what kind of fungus was my favorite? I stared at her in bewilderment, her face suspended in breathless expectation, as if my answer might shape the very course of our relationship. Being a history student and not one of the scientific variety, I gave her a blank look and answered simply, the red ones? She hadn't seemed too pleased with my answer, her shoulders deflating with a sigh. Should have figured, she muttered. And that was the last thing she said to me for the next few days. Every time I tried to engage her in some amicable conversation, she would reply with grunts and shrugs, as if I wasn't worth talking to. It made rooming with her a difficult and unpleasant affair, but I had my own studies to focus on, so I tried my best to get on with things and not pay her too much mind. But it was hard to ignore her peculiar interests. Sometimes, when I would come back to the dorm after a full day on campus, I would notice a weird smell in the room, and I would find my roommate hunched over her desk, tinkering with her petri dishes and examining things under her microscope. I figured she was just doing research for her classes, but did she have to do it in such a cramped, shared environment? The stuff she was growing inside those containers looked disgusting. Dark growths and mucus-like substances that stunk when I got too close. I probably should have complained to the dorm manager and switched rooms, but I had too much other stuff on my plate, so I delayed it for a while longer. I hadn't exactly spoken to my roommate about it. If I brought up the smells, she might be sympathetic enough to move her experiments elsewhere. But for the most part, I ignored it, and I spent as little time as possible in the dorm, only using it as a place to sleep. Until one night, when I woke up to a strange light in the room. It wasn't very bright, but it was enough to wake me up and catch my attention. An undulating, bluish-gray light that I had never seen before. It was coming from the other side of the room, specifically from my roommate's desk. I flicked a glance over to her bed and saw her asleep beneath the covers, so it wasn't her doing. Half asleep and curious, I crawled out of bed and padded over to see what was emitting the strange glow. To my surprise and horror, it was coming from one of the petri dishes. One of the fungi inside was glowing. I lifted up the dish to take a closer look and—
What are you doing?
I jumped at the voice, the petri dish slipping between my fingers. It smashed against the floor at my feet, the glow immediately disappearing. My roommate screeched in horror, fumbling to turn the light on, and I stared down at the spilled fungus. Some of it had touched my bare foot, the substance cold and sticky. Nausea twisted my stomach, and I ran to the bathroom to wash it off as quickly as possible. I didn't stop scrubbing until my skin was red and raw, but at least I had gotten rid of every trace. When I got back, my roommate was crouched on the floor trying to scoop up what was left of the shattered sample. After that, things only got worse. My roommate continued her experiments with the fungus, and strange things started happening to me. I would wake up in the night and I'd see things in the room. Shadows crawling across the walls, things moving along the floor, slithering and creeping like something alive. The whole room would smell like rot, like something decaying beneath a pile of wet leaves. One time, I awoke to an itch on my arm. The more I tried to scratch it away, the worse it got, spreading and moving around my body. And I kept itching and itching until my skin started breaking away beneath my fingernails and I was covered in red welts. When I pushed back the covers to see if there was anything on me, I saw shadows beneath my skin, like something was growing there. Something that kept moving, growing, creeping through my body. I knew it was the fungus. It had to be. It was in the air. Spores spreading from the petri dishes on my roommate's desk. Or maybe it was because of the one I dropped, the one that had touched my bare skin. And now it was inside me, infecting me, eating me away from the inside. Eventually, I couldn't take it anymore. The rotten stench, the hallucinations, the things growing under my skin. One afternoon, when my roommate was out, I walked over to her desk and I gathered up all the petri dishes, all the samples of fungi that she'd been experimenting on, and I binned them all, threw them all into the trash. It was the only way to stop them from spreading, to prevent them infecting me any further. She was furious when she came back, accused me of ruining her life's work. I told her it was her fault for leaving them there. In the end, she was the one who asked for a transfer to a different dorm. At least she took her fungus with her.
I stifled another yawn and stared sleepily through the window of the gas station. I was the only attendant on duty, and we had just hit the late afternoon lull, where I'd probably only get a few more cars in the next hour. This time of day always went the slowest, when the clock was creeping closer towards the end of the shift, but there were still 2 full hours to get through with very little to do. The gas station was on the outskirts of a small rural town, which meant we didn't get as much traffic as the inner city facilities. But we were close enough to a highway that we saw a decent number of cars pass through. In all of my 5 years of working here as an attendant, nothing exciting had ever happened. The folks around here were a mixture of friendly and reserved, but we never got anyone too aggressive or troublesome. For the most part, every day was the same, which suited me well enough. I picked up the motor magazine I was reading from the counter and flipped through some of the pages, keeping an eye on the security monitors and the pumps through the window. A few cars drove by, but none stopped by to fill up. Another 20 minutes passed before the next car signaled to turn into the station. I flicked a brief glance through the window, watching the beat-up Mustang roll towards one of the gas pumps. The windows were tinted far more than regulations allowed, obscuring the driver from view, though the silhouette I glimpsed through them definitely seemed masculine. I returned my gaze to the magazine, hearing a car door open and slam shut. Dealing with a customer would at least give me something to do. Maybe they'd even give me more than the perfunctory exchange of paying for their gas and immediately leaving. Not that I was desperate for conversation, but it took the edge off the creeping loneliness of working at a rural gas station. I finished the rest of the article and glanced towards the window, wondering if the driver was having trouble since it had been more than 5 minutes since I'd heard him exit his car. I frowned, scanning my gaze over the empty lot outside. The car was still there, but I couldn't see the man. Where had he gone? I checked the meter for the fuel supply and noticed it hadn't gone down on the pump he was parked in front of. He hadn't filled up either. I got out of my seat and pressed closer to the window, gazing across the full lot. The man was nowhere to be seen. Had he gone around the back of the station? We had a public convenience, but it was currently out of use due to some drainage issues. I went back to the counter and checked the CCTV cameras. We only had 2 on the premises, 1 in the store and 1 recording the pumps. I had no eyes on the back of the station, which is the only other place he could be. With a sigh, I decided to go and double check he wasn't up to anything behind the station. I'd caught a kid smoking back there once, which could have ended very badly if he'd gotten any closer to the petrol tanks. I locked the front door and went through the storage room to the back door, emerging into the walled area where we kept the garbage cans. The public convenience was a small brick building next to the station, an out-of-order sign hanging on the front door. I flicked at a glance around the area, seeing nobody else, and walked up to the toilets. I tried the door, but it was locked, so he definitely wasn't inside. Just to be sure, I opened it up with the key around my belt and poked my head inside. The stench of raw sewage and stagnant water was enough to make my eyes water, and I quickly recoiled. Definitely nobody stupid enough to be hiding in there. I locked it back up and went around the front of the station, where the car was still sitting, seemingly abandoned. I walked up to the front windows and peered inside, but there was definitely nobody in there. Where had the driver gone? I'd seen him behind the wheel, heard the car door open and closed, and then it was like he vanished. Why would he drive his car here just to abandon it? Had he run out of gas and couldn't afford anymore? But why would he leave it right in front of the pump and then just leave? I checked the road leading away from the gas station, but there was nobody else around for miles, no cars, and no people. I was getting really puzzled by it all when I heard something behind me, a soft thump. I turned back to the Mustang, staring in bewilderment at the empty car. What was that? I took a step closer and stopped when I heard it again. This time, heavier and more desperate, two thumps, coming unmistakably from the trunk of the car. Was there something in there? I hurried to the trunk, my heart in my throat, and listened. Something moved inside, and I heard what sounded like a faint moan. Was there a person inside? I instinctively stumbled back, my heart pounding in my chest. What was I supposed to do in this situation? If there was someone in the trunk, did that mean they were hurt? Kidnapped? Should I call the police or check it out first? I didn't want to call 911 without verifying what I thought was happening. I might be wrong. It might just be an animal in there. Taking a deep breath, I approached the trunk again. Inside, everything had gone quiet. I almost started to wonder if I'd just imagined those sounds. Fumbling beneath the lip of the trunk, I found the mechanism to pop it open and pressed it in. For a second, I worried the car was locked and it would set off the alarm, but the trunk opened easily. A smell washed out from within. There was a person inside. A dead one. I could tell she was dead immediately from the pallid tone of her skin and the unnatural gray tinge of her lips. Her chest wasn't moving either. It looked like she had been dead for a while, judging by the smell. But if that was the case, how had I heard her trying to get out? And the driver, was he the one who had killed her? Had he dumped the car here with her body so that someone would find it? I stumbled away, dizzy and nauseous, fighting back the bile in my throat as the reality sunk in. There was a dead body, and the murderer might still be somewhere close by. Leaving the trunk open, I ran back to the station, fumbling with the front door before realizing I'd locked it from the inside. Cursing, I fished the keys from my belt, dropping them twice in the process, and finally managed to make it to the phone behind the counter. I dialed 911 and explained the situation as calmly as I could, despite the panic squeezing my chest. Who was the woman in the trunk? Who was the driver? What was happening? The police managed to get here before any other cars turned up, and they cordoned off the area for an investigation. The first thing they asked me to do after recounting the events was pull up CCTV. If the man had climbed out of the car in front of the pump, his face would be on record. I pulled up the footage and rewound it back to the moment the Mustang had pulled up. The person who climbed out of the driver's seat was a man, somewhere over 6 foot with a large build, dressed in a black jumper and jeans. His face was hidden behind a pair of sunglasses and a hat that mostly cast his face into shadow, even beneath the lights of the gas station. The police were able to create a brief sketch of the suspect, but nothing that gave them a concrete idea of who he was. They took away the body and the car, and the gas station was open for business again a day later, though I took a few days off to get my head into a better place after discovering the body. A week after the incident, the police were able to share a few details with me about the investigation. The woman in the trunk matched the victim of a missing persons report from a few towns over, who had been abducted a few weeks ago and never found. According to the coroner, she had been dead at least a day by the time I found her, which made no sense given the noises I had heard coming from the car, the noises that had led me to investigate in the first place. The suspect still hadn't been positively ID'd or apprehended, but the case matched another one that was being investigated in another state, involving a body in a car that had been left at a gas station with the driver nowhere to be seen. Whoever had murdered that girl and left her there, he was still out there, looking for his next victim.
there was something about me that my husband never understood. But after so many years of being with Xavier, he had come to learn how to accept my quirks and likes, even the ones he never seemed to understand. That was probably why we were married for so long. He was so understanding. One of those things I liked that he didn't understand was shopping. It didn't have to be clothes shopping or even buying skincare and makeup products. It didn't have to be an expensive Chanel for it to make me happy. It could be something as simple as grocery shopping at the nearest shopping mall to us, which happened to be Costco. Xavier and I lived in a small and sleepy town that people often forgot existed. A town that made everything seem like a fever dream. It was beautiful to live in our small town of Florine. But it could be equally scary, as it could be really quiet. It reminded me of a dream I had only this morning, which was the reason for my impromptu shopping as a form of therapy. In my dream, I woke up and realized that I was the only one in existence. I couldn't find Xavier, and the old lady next door wasn't rocking on her chair. Even our cat's meow was gone. In my dream, I searched everywhere for any sign of life, and I couldn't even find a squirrel or an ant. It was a terrifying nightmare that had me shaking and sweating when I woke up. I grabbed my car keys the moment I woke up, kissed Xavier, and told him I was going shopping. He bade me goodbye, told me he would be off for work, and let me know that he needed a few things too. So I wound up at this Costco branch, which was buzzing with people. The chill of my nightmare lingered, and I couldn't shake it off, even as I reminded myself that it was only a dream and not real. I walked down the aisles, picked out random things, and added them to the carts. It was therapeutic, and it was already working, because I felt much better as I wheeled my cart away. I couldn't help but notice there were more people than usual today. I marveled at it. There only seemed to be people streaming in, and nobody left. And I have sworn I saw things happen more than once, like a sort of deja vu. Like the little girl in the pink jumper who hurried to add Fruit Loops into her mother's cart, and her mother taking it out. Then the little girl's face turned red, and her mother finally agreed to get it. "Mommy, I want it, please," the little girl would wail. "Fine." The mother sighed as she plopped the Fruit Loops back into the cart. "But I'm not getting anything else." It seemed to be happening in a constant loop. I had to blink several times to make sense of my reality, and even then it was a bit foggy. Was I still asleep? I tried to pinch myself, and I felt my skin hurt from it. I was awake. I decided to shake it off as I made my way toward the cake mix aisles and picked up a few boxes of pancakes and cake. I realized my muscles were cramped as I walked. I could barely take fast steps, and the world around me seemed to slow down. I didn't get it. I tried to shake it off, but it wasn't possible. I wanted to leave, but Costco wasn't helping as I began to feel even more weirded out than I was after the dream. I went to the ice cream aisle to get my favorite flavor. And then perhaps I would return home and cuddle up in front of the television and try to forget the weirdness of the day. Another loop happened at the ice cream aisle. This time around, there were two teenagers arguing over the best flavor. "I don't think there's any flavor better than vanilla. It's basic, but it's the best," one of the girls said. "It's the Oreo one." Then they went ahead and got the flavors, but they returned and it happened all over again. I was losing my mind. I was sure of it. I tried to talk to the girls, but they didn't respond, almost like they didn't hear me. I looked around and tried to speak to others, but no one spoke to me. I wanted to cry, but the tears didn't come out, and the world blurred around me. I abandoned the cart in the middle of the store and ran for the exit door, but it felt like I was walking in water and my movements were slowed, and the exit door suddenly vanished. I looked around, and people that seemed to have filled up the entire store seemed to vanish right before my eyes. One by one, they all disappeared, and it was just me, alone once more in a store so large and an exit nowhere to be found. I felt trapped inside. I couldn't even speak or scream for help. Who would I call when it seemed as though I were the only one around? And yet, I did try to scream. I tried, but the sound didn't come out, and my mind spun. A crippling feeling took over me, and I felt as though I were drowning in my own body. I felt pain all over my body, and soon, Costco began to fade away around me, and I was met by a new reality. Metal, the sharp scent of something antiseptic, and the loud ticking of a clock against the wall. I closed my eyes shut and tried to wake myself from this seemingly endless nightmare. I wanted to return home and never sleep a wink again. I forced my eyes open, and I met a stranger looking down at me. He was wearing a surgical mask, but this wasn't the hospital. I knew because the walls were made of metal, and I was strapped against a chair. The weird gadgets around me scared me. I didn't want to be here for another second, and yet I was trapped. The man looking down at me turned towards another man and said to him, "Operation Costco is a complete fail. The subject only lasted in the simulation for 3 minutes." My mind was spinning. I didn't understand what they said. Was this all a simulation? What were these men doing to me? I felt helpless as I watched someone hand this man with the mask a freakishly looking injection that looked like it hurt more than anything. "I am injecting the suspect with a stronger serum this time around, and hopefully, this will be the one that keeps her in a dream loop for eternity," the man said. My blood ran cold, and I felt terrified and scared of what the man meant. I tried to struggle against the straps that held me in place, but my limbs were jelly and I couldn't move. I watched helplessly as I was injected, and soon, my world went blank. And then, I breathed in the fresh air around me. I was in the middle of Costco, and I had never been happier. I strolled through the aisles, happily looking for groceries we needed at home, and I watched the people around me go on with their day. Although I was happy, and Costco seemed like a paradise, I couldn't shake off the odd feeling that something was wrong, and I didn't know why.